Yeah. Afternoon. Actually, I've slightly changed my topic. Decided to teach Zizek, more or less, and follow Bruno Postel's in considering Badia without Zizek. But I think, anyway, that much of what I will say on Badia is also relevant and somehow relates to Zizek as well, because these two, as they have themselves declared, form a sort of politburo of two. Anyway, my starting point is the revolutionary movements of recent years, 2011 especially, from the Arab Spring, of course, the most major event, to the European protests and also the Occupy movement in the United States. And as Ulrika mentioned, my interest is also in the Western reactions to these events, or the way how Western governments were in pains to show that they have, especially the Arab events, have nothing to do with their policies or the protest movements that were taking place in Western countries at the same time. And I think these revolutions, especially the Arab Spring, I think that's the main phenomenon here, is like all revolutions, global in its significance and repercussions. And I think the task of political thought is to draw home the lessons from such events. And I follow Hannah Arendt, who argued that the political lessons of the modern revolutions have been forgotten, not only because of their political trajectories, but also because they were nowhere, and I quote, matched by an adequate development of new thought. So I think that from the perspective of political theory, these events have forced us to reconsider some of the established habits of reflection that have dominated our thinking in recent decades. So as Judith Butler has argued, our ideas of action need to be rethought. And in this paper I engage in the effort of such rethinking, albeit in somewhat different lines than Butler herself. So if we are fully to bring home the lessons of 2011, I argue we must take revolution seriously as a category of thought and action. And we must turn our attention to revolutionary tradition and to thinkers who reflect on such tradition. And in this particular paper, I approach this task from the perspective of Arendt on the one hand and Alain Badia on the other, as I said. Both are passionate defenders of the revolutionary tradition and what Arendt called its lost treasure. Now, despite this obvious connection in terms of revolutionary thinking, bringing Arendt and Badia into dialogue might seem like a far stretch. And indeed, Badia's own comments on Arendt have been predominantly hostile. He would, no doubt, second Zizek in seeing the increased interest towards Arendt's thinking as, I quote Zizek, the clearest sign of the theoretical defeat of the left. So in his Metapolitics, Badia's Metapolitics, Arendt appears as someone who reduces politics to spectatorship, ethics of rights, and inactivist parliamentarism. Now, as any who has ever read a book by Arendt will notice, this presentation has almost nothing to do with the real content of her talk. So rather than a substantial criticism, Badia's attack on Arendt is a painful testimony to the failure to take her thought seriously. But all this notwithstanding, I argue that a fruitful and constructive dialogue can be entertained between Arendtian and Badian insights. And I will note three particular areas of such dialogue, or where such dialogue could be initiated. So these are revolutions as proper new beginnings, instituting temporal duration as a part of revolutionary action, and, well, as a broad category, affective dimensions of political action and organization. And naturally, in all these areas, I will also note some differences between the two others. And we'll argue more or less that it is Arendt's strains of thought that leave us with somewhat better prepared for making justice to revolutionary upheavals similar to the ones seen in the Arab world and the Egypt, especially in 2011. So the most obvious commonality between Arendt and Badiou probably emerges from the conception of revolution as a radical break to the temporal flow of the situation that exists and to the existing order as such. Now, for Badiou, this naturally comes in the shape of an event, definitely the most well-known of his concepts. An event is the form taken by any, I quote, genuine change in the world. In other words, a break, a discontinuity in the protocol of the appearances of beings or of their existence. End of quote. An event is something that brings the inexistence of the world to maximal existence and constitutes the opening of a new possibility. Now, Arendt also emphasizes the eventual nature of revolutions. They, as Arendt points out, I quote, are the only political events which confront us directly and inevitably with the problem of beginning. So like Badiou's events that come out as exceptions to the existing regime of appearance, revolutionary events for Arendt appear as unconnected novelties breaking into the continuous sequence of historical time. Further, like Badiou, Arendt brings forth the possibility-opening nature of political acts. They open a curious empty space, a hiatus, between the old world, that is no longer, and the new one, which is not yet anything else but a possibility. And I think something like this is clearly what we witnessed in the early days of the Egyptian revolution in 2011. There was radical change, or change radical enough to break off from the rules of pre-2011 Egyptian world, as well as the perception of that world by outsiders. It is hardly deniable that January 25 constitutes a beginning of an event in the Egyptian scene, one that culminated in the overthrowing of Mubarak. While preceding and prepared by small-scale activism for years, the events beginning in the end of the end of January 2011 cannot but appear as somewhat unconnected novelty, abolishing the smooth sequence of historical time. Paraphrase Arendt. But here we might already passing the note two differences between Arendt and Badiou. First is that Arendt does not concur with Badiou's analysis, one that is shared by Ranciere among others, that connects the revolution in one way or another to the role of the inexistent, which nevertheless was an element in the empirical reality of the Egyptian revolution. So this line of thought can be employed as a criticism of Arendt. On the other hand, from Arendt's perspective, we can note that given that Badiou rejects the state as a form from the beginning, he consequently seems to be incapable of analyzing the emergence of revolutionary events from the loss of legitimacy of the state. So Arendt is better able to eliminate the dynamics of a revolutionary situation where the power is, as she says, lying in the street or on the street, waiting to be picked up by revolutionary actors. Now, for both Arendt and Badiou, the real political problem of revolutions is the move from the initial evental spark, the moment of beginning, to temporal durability. In Badiou's terms, it is here that the question of subject comes up. For, I quote, "the entire effort lies in following the event's consequences, not in glorifying its occurrence," end of quote. And this is the task of the faithful subject, the political militant. And the work of the subject is related to truth procedure, whereby the truth of the event becomes part of the world. The subject first makes an intervention, affirming that there has been an event in the first place, and then starts the almost endless process of bringing the truth of the event into the world. In politics, this subjective effort comes down to the question of organization. Now, on the face of it, Badiou's faithful subject that is devoted to the truth process seems to have little interface with anything that Arendt had said about political action. But I think this is a hasty judgment. Arendt's problem is, I quote, "how to preserve the revolutionary spirit, how to find lasting institutions which could prevent this experience from being the experience of only one generation." For her, this translates into a question of world building. As several commentators have recently pointed out, correcting some of the earlier misreadings of Arendt, it is critical that action involves not only a surprising beginning, but also completing, continuing, carrying through. It could even be argued that what Arendt calls power is a general conceptual name for this self-same problem. And this, I think, is the upshot of Bachin Markel's recent set of rereadings of Arendt, in which he argues that Arendt's notion of power takes a form of power after. Power is like action's shadow, which, quote Markel, which gives action duration, but draws out a spontaneous flash of novelty on the part of a single agent, or kind, into a course of action in which others, some of the lingering, undispersed witnesses to the initial event, join and extend and continue, protein. In this line of thought, Arendt's world building and power can be read in the context of Badiou's subjective truth processes. They also include elements somewhat similar to the operation of fidelity or faithfulness in Badiou. Finally, both Arendt and Badiou are unwilling to define what forms of organization the movement should take. This is a task for the political actors and not theorists. However, and here we enter the domain where the differences between Arendt and Badiou are really starting to show up. In his writings of recent years, Badiou has increasingly emphasized the importance of a further element in political truth processes, namely that of an idea, or the idea of communism in particular, which he defines as a kind of historical projection of what the historical becoming of politics is going to be. So something that Badiou thought, this is something that Badiou thought was lacking in the uprisings of 2011. There wasn't a clearly articulated idea. While this has some similarities to Arendt's discussion on principles, it ultimately differs from them by being more precise, which is exactly the problem, I think. It seems to me that by demanding something for action's yardstick that is more precise than a principle, yet more general than a goal, Badiou is entering dangerous waters. He might be turning the idea as something that guides and restricts the political process too much, effectively eliminating the experience of freedom emphasized by Arendt. In other words, yet Padilla's discussion on the ideas relation to political organization might hint towards a highly problematic residue of means-ends thinking in his philosophy. This, in my reading, is connected to Padilla's commitment to popular dictatorship as the most promising form of revolutionary organization. Even though Padilla celebrates the enthusiasm felt in the early stages of an uprising, he refuses to consider even the possibility of finding a way to institute some duration to the to this affective element. This is in blatant contradiction with Arendt, who celebrates the joy in action and public happiness felt in the wards, Soviets, and councils that often emerge in the early stages of a revolution, and therefore hopes to find ways to find more enduring forms for the revolutionary spirit cultivated in such public spaces. Now, I think this is particularly pertinent in the case of the 2011 uprisings. As Kostas Doutsinas has argued, the kind of political discipline and authoritarian relationship with the population as a whole is exactly the kind of politics that is rejected by the recent uprisings. If, then, we want to be faithful to the event, that is, these uprisings, we should take seriously their claims. Padilla seems to me to be too keen of defining the truth of the movements for them, and unsurprisingly ends up defining it as the truth of communism that has been part of his philosophy for decades. But if the idea of the uprisings is the form of organization, what if the idea of the uprisings is the form of organization they embody? So here again, the remnants of a means-ends thinking criticism that I raised earlier comes to the fore. If for Padilla, I quote, "democracy is not the political truth itself, but one of the means for finding the political truth," we get the feeling that he's asking political actors to surrender to a higher end without really giving any reasons for them to do so. For Arendt, on the other hand, the means are often more important than the ends, because achieving the ends remains more or less aleatory. What the movement nourished, then, is more important than what they accomplish. This is also, after all, much closer to the demands of the actors of the Egyptian Spring of 2011. For instance, after the name of Mohamed El Baradei had been introduced as a potential replacer for Mubarak, a Twitter user from Tahrir Square commented, I quote, "the popular committees hold seats for what direct democracy could look like in the future. We need to focus on them instead of Baradei." End of quote. So let me conclude on one final and important point. And on this point, Arendt and Padilla are again in agreement. So when it comes to the uprisings in the Arab world in 2011, there was an enormous effort by external powers to downplay the eventual nature of the upheavals. The EU, for instance, knowingly or not, presented the attempts at liberation in Egypt and elsewhere as nothing more than desire for West, as Padilla succinctly puts it. The revolutionary hiatus, the open horizon after liberation and before the fateful attempt at world building, was then cancelled. In Padilla's terms, a reactionary form of subjectivity prevailed, creating, I quote, "a measured present, a negative present, a present a little less worse than the past, if only because it resisted the catastrophic temptation which the reactive subject declares is contained in the event. We will call it an extinguished present," end of quote. Now, in contrast to such reactionism, the ethical political maxim shared by Arendt and Padilla is to retain an attunement to events and their novelty. "Take care of what is born," Padilla urges in the final pages of his Logics of Worlds. "Take care of novelties and practice endurance in trying to keep their spirit alive." this is what could be called a revolutionary notion of political hope